and welcome to episode 454 of the Creating Crowbar, a gaming podcast being recorded on the 28th of January 2026. And if you're following along from some other part of the multiverse, we're recording from the fuck-ass dumb shit hell zone timeline. I'm Marsh Davis, or rather a multiply degenerate sub-branch of the median Marsh that only occurs in the most cursed percentile of possible universes. But joining me today from a much better world is the empirically perfect entity, the statuesque, bebearded He-Man of video games. Here to bring light to both game journalism and our benighted reality altogether, I talk of none other than Graham Smith, the Golden Graham.
Hello. What an introduction. What an introduction that I just immediately cannot live up to. Even, you know, the sound of my voice is immediately disappointing people right now.
Not true. Not true. Welcome back to the podcast, Graham. It's very nice to talk to you.
It's very nice to be here. It's been several years since I have been on this podcast, or indeed any podcast. As I was just saying to you before we started recording, I don't really remember how to do this, how to have conversations, what microphones are, what I'm supposed to be doing here. So this is going to go great.
Well, the secret is we've never known how to do those things.
Good.
But it's very nice to talk to you. And it's very nice to read your words again on a brand new reader-supported gaming website, which you should tell us all about right now.
Thank you. I've returned to the podcast for one episode only so that I can shell my wares. That's what I'm here for. Finally, we've got advertising in the podcast after all these years.
Usually require us to be paid in some way?
We'll work that out after. I have started a website with two other people who may be familiar to listeners, Brendan Caldwell, former features editor of Rock Paper Shotgun, and with John Hicks, who was previously editor-in-chief of Official Xbox Magazine back in the day, but more recently was an editorial director at Gamer Network. And so essentially he was my boss when I was running RPS. He was running me, as well as Eurogamer and other websites. And so between the three of us, we've got a lot of experience in games journalism, and we've decided we cannot stop, despite the industry and all common sense demanding that we should. We have decided to go it alone and launch our own website called Jank, which you can visit right now on the internet at jank.cool, which is our URL. And as you said, it's a reader-funded website focused on PC games. We're going to be posting articles every day and doing the things that you can really only do when you're reader supported, which means writing things that don't necessarily drive enormous numbers of views, but which hopefully are the kinds of articles that people love, you know, based on our experience of doing that at Rock Paper Shotgun for so many years. So in-depth reviews, in-depth interviews, lots of fun and entertaining and opinionated writing, hopefully not doing guides, not doing deals posts, not doing a daily churn of news. We'll only write news stories when we've got an opinion or something worthwhile to say. Not having adverts or affiliate links or auto-playing video chasing you down the page as you scroll. Not having trackers invading your privacy and keeping track of all the dodgy things that you're buying on Amazon that you maybe don't want Facebook to know about. All that good stuff on a we're not doing. We just have a very clean website with good words on it, is the plan. At the time, as we're talking right now, we've just launched a couple of days ago. It's going quite well so far. For the first month, all of the articles are free. After that point, we will turn on a paywall for some of the articles. But you can pay us some money now if you'd like to, and we would like if you'd like to, because we need to without advertising, we need to find some other way of making this sustainable. By subscribing now, you get access to an exclusive Discord server, you get some fortnightly podcast episodes by our friends at Total Playtime, which is the podcast that John Hicks does with Alice Bell, former Rock Paper Shotgun deputy editor, and we'll be launching our own podcast a jank podcast to compete with Crate and Crowbar in a little over a month's time. So yeah, at this stage, we would just be happy if people turned up and read it, and we didn't sink into the quagmire of the internet completely unnoticed right away. And commenting will always be free. So any of the free articles that we put up, you can come and yell at us underneath them without needing to pay us a dime.
Mm. And some people already have, because of your light trolling in the best games of the decade so far article, which I very much enjoyed. And the whole website's really good already. There's loads of, you've packed it full of at least a page and a bit of content already. It's been a long while since I've looked at any other gaming website than Rock Paper Shotgun, because usually loading their ad layer on any given modern website today causes my laptop to fully stop and become a hot plate. I'm pleased to say that the only incendiary thing on your website are the opinions. yeah, it's good. And that list feature particularly delighted me, because I think people assume that like list features are a feature of the modern web in its terrible form, because they traffic reasonably well, they bait engagement, and they can be stuffed with things like affiliate links and the like. But obviously yours isn't, and the format predates that, because they are just like this sort of eternal and, you know, like purely alluring thing where you list a bunch of great stuff that you love. And if done well, I think it really kind of, you know, it evokes real passion, and it celebrates, particularly in this case, it celebrates the just enormous breadth and diversity of gaming that we have today. There's just so many genres in evidence, and quite a few games that defy any genre at all. So maybe this timeline isn't quite so cursed after all. Maybe you have rescued me from my pit of despond.
That's what we're selling here at Jank. We're selling hope. I love list features. We obviously, you know, prior to the internet, we worked on magazines, and list features were a staple of magazines since time immemorial, whether it was the yearly PC Gamer Top 100 or whether it was genre-specific lists that we would run throughout. They're a really good way of expressing to the readership what your values are, what your expertise are, and we wanted to lead with that. Like, here, you know, look at all the games we have played. Look how exciting PC gaming is. I think there's also some power in the fact that, hey, this is a really long list feature with 68 games on it, and it's all on a single page. It's not paginated, because there are ways in which the list feature has been warped by internet and the way that commerce works on the internet. Turning it into a multi-page article is one of them, because they need to get page views to get to show as many ads as possible. But even beyond that, what you realize with lists on the internet, having done them for years and years and years and years and years, is that, you know, when we used to do a list in the magazine, we would update that list maybe once a year or maybe less. Whereas if you're only updating your list once a year on the internet, then it's going to drop down the Google search rankings, and that list is going to stop getting traffic. So you have to update it weekly, at the least, really. And if there's no cause to update that list, then, well, really, you're just massaging the intro and pretending that it's new for the audience. But then the warping of these lists goes further than that, because what you also work out is, if your list doesn't have the games on it that the audience is expecting, then they won't spend as long on the page. So, you know, if they've searched for best strategy games and they're not met with a list that they expect, then they lose interest in that list. They click the back button, they go to Google, and that sends the signal to Google, oh, I guess that list is no good. And so that drops down. So there becomes this kind of commercial pressure to put the games on the list that other people expect to be there, rather than just obeying your own taste. And naturally, you know, we've just launched Jank. There's only the three of us. We've played a lot of games, but we've played a finite number of them. We haven't played everything in the world. And we don't have any money to go fill out our number by asking 10 other people to contribute to the list. And so
you've chosen to commit like page rank seppuku by foregoing putting Elden Ring on your list.
Essentially, because none of us like Elden Ring. And, you know, 1000X Resist feels like a game that probably would be on there if any of us had played it. and we just haven't, because it's just one of the games that we haven't got to yet. And so we just kind of have to be okay with those blind spots and trust the readership to be okay with those blind spots. You know, we're putting this list out there and saying, this is who we are. And that's what it's about, you know, and it still hopefully fulfills the function of readers coming to it and learning about games that they hadn't heard of otherwise, or helping them to steer them towards what they're going to play next. But yeah, it is a very different way from how things are done on some of the big commercial websites, which I won't name,
It's a fantastic list. There's a few games that I hadn't heard of as well. Usually really ugly looking weird games that Brendan likes.
Is that Babdi?
Babdi. Well, I played Babdi on the recommendation of it. I fucking love it. It's great.
Yeah, it's but brilliant,
there's,
isn't it?
There's at least several Babdi likes on that list, which is just, you know, like,
Yeah.
The games that you look at and you think, that should smell, like that should emit an odor. But yeah, Babdi's super.
Yeah, I really love Babdi. But and like Babdi is by the same developers of Straftat. I think they're one of the few developers that have actually got two games on the list.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I think they're French. Is that right? But they're
that seems plausible. they're playing their games.
It's a first person exploration game set in a brutalist cityscape. It's sort of like what if Mirror's Edge was really unwell, just like so unwell that the kindest thing to do to it would be just to hit it with a cinder block. It's your main goal is just to leave the city by a train, but and it's reasonably trivial to do that, but there's just loads of other really inane things to do in the city and loads of ways to traverse it with a mix of sort of parkour platforming and leaf blowers and it's so foul and funny. It's just like a deformed little creature fishing in a manhole cover, and the only thing she says to you is sewer oil. I don't know, brutalism seems to be having a kind of like a pleasant resurgence within games. Like it feels like game developers are rediscovering brutalism, you know, a century later. Obviously with Control, but then also the Talos Principle too. And now the Quake Brutalist Jam and its sequel. Have you played that, by the way?
I haven't yet, unfortunately. No, I really want to, because some of the level designers that have made things with it are really great designers. Like Robert Yang, for example, has made a level that's in it, and I've been looking at the screenshots, and I'm really keen to play it.
Terrible clipping issues, but gorgeous to look at. It's just an amazing showcase of imagined architecture. It's almost a shame that they're in a game that you have to play rather than just walk through, because I find that I'm simply not good enough at Quake. the difficulty rankings that they've set definitely overestimate my ability. But yeah, what were the other games? I like that Jusant made your list.
I really love climbing in games. Climbing, I think for me, I think I say this in the list, it's really like a fundamental fantasy of like more than, you know, people talk about wanting to be able to fly like Superman and that being a thing that they experience in dreams and stuff like that. I'm much more interested in being able to hoist myself up a cliff face by my fingertips, a thing I will never attempt to do nor be able to do. You know, and I really like that documentary film Free Solo about Alex Honnold scaling the big El Capitan without ropes. I've watched that film several times and just sweat out of my palms the entire time it's on screen. And you know, and Jusant is obviously, you know, I'm sat very comfortably in my chair as I play it. You know, and it's not a VR experience. There's lots of VR climbing games where you have to actually lift your arms above your head. That's too much exercise for me. But despite being said in this kind of a fantasy world, the actual climbing of it respects the laws of physics. You know, there are plants and various different materials on the cliff faces as you're climbing up, but fundamentally you have to manage your stamina and the power of your arms and find the handholds and rest your arms where you can and tie yourself up where you can. And that's just such a compelling, meaty, natural source of challenge that I find really compelling in games. Less keen of the story in Jusant. I could have done with about 60% fewer notes written about the environment to read. But as a climbing experience, I think it's unparalleled.
Yeah. I think there's only the only game on the list that maybe go, come on, was Halo Infinite, which I think is a completely confounding choice. But, you know, horses for courses, or like master horses for space gorilla courses.
Not one of my picks, so I'm not going to sit here and defend it.
were there any games that your colleagues chose that you thought, what the fuck?
No. I believe in the big church of PC gaming, so like there was nothing on there. You know, if anything, I feel like my choices were far more dubious than anyone else's, probably, as I'm picking things like Infinite Craft, which is a browser game, which is not really a game at all. It is just you have a big open canvas and you have a set of words written down the right hand side of the screen. You can drag those words onto the canvas and then combine them to make new words. And there you can kind of self-set a goal of like trying to create as many newer words as possible, but there's no point to it. It is literally infinite. And it is a game about like, oh, if I drag the word vampire onto the word pirate, it makes the word vampirate. Wonder what happens if I then drag the word God onto that, you know, and just seeing what happens. And it obviously, like, it was the game Scribblenauts, which I think was originally like a DS game maybe, but yeah. I think does exist on PC now, which let you do a bit of that. You were combining things from sprites, but Infinite Craft is so much larger a toy box just because it's purely words and they don't have to draw anything. So if my colleagues are willing to let me have Infinite Craft on there and Fall Guys on there and the NORP apologue on there, which is an incremental game, then I can't judge their picks at all.
Tell me more about the NORP apologue. I don't remember seeing that.
The NORP apologue. So I got really into incremental games last year. And incremental games wasn't really a term that I'd heard much. I'd heard of idle games and people talking about that. But the word, the name incremental game, as the genre title, seems to have become more common, in part because idle game doesn't really fit most of these games. They're not truly idle, at least not the ones that I'm playing. You are typically doing something. The NORP apologue. NORPs are tiny little pixel people that will run to a big rock in the middle of the screen and hit the rock. And when they hit the rock, some sort of material spills out of it and piles up next to the rock. And you are then trying to maximize the efficiency of this process because, well, you need to get more NORPs to then go over and pick up the resource and collect it and process it. And as you add more NORPs, you unlock buildings that you can place down, and it becomes this little management game where eventually the screen is just totally awash with particle effects, pixels flying everywhere as you smash these rock to bits, make giant piles of material next to it, process that, and eventually destroy it all and start over again. And the reason I got really into incremental games is because they kind of boil down a lot of the power curve of larger video games into something you can experience in 4 or 5 hours. You know, like they feel like video game concentrate to me. And usually there's no skill involved, but there is some satisfying interaction at the core of it. Like NORP's apologue, it's really satisfying just watching it play out, the sound effects, the mess and chaos of it all as it grows and grows and grows is really satisfying. There's another one which didn't make the list called To the Core, I think, which is basically you're drilling down into the center of planets to, again, consume resources and destroy those planets. And again, it's a pixelated game, and as you drill down, pixels are flying everywhere. And initially, you're just like this little craft in the sky that you can't steer, you can't move, you can't do anything. You're just going to fall, you're going to make a little dent in the surface of a planet, and then explode. And then you're going to do it again, and you're going to do it again. And then the third time, you're going to get enough resource that, oh, now I can unlock the upgrade that lets me move left and right. And now you go down and you can go left and right, and you get resources a little bit faster that way because you could steer towards the pocket of a particular material you could see underground. And then, you know, about 45 minutes later, you're just this absolute sky death falling down upon these planets, consuming them like a plague of locusts, drones spread out all over you, missiles flying everywhere, targeting particular resources, chewing through planets in the, from top to bottom in the space of a minute, the planet destroying and then moving off to another planet somewhere else in the solar system and repeating the process again and again and again. And it's fantastic. And you will get bored of it if you're like me after about two nights of playing it. But so what? Like, that's two nights of fun. And yeah, the NORP epilogue, I would recommend to anyone. I want to recommend Strafdat, which is the other game, because we talked about Bubdy. And that's, as you said, this sort of austere, brutalist, strange, sick single player experience. And Strafdat, it has the exact same aesthetic and art style and character designs, but then within it, creates this sort of Quake 3 Mario Party mini game sort of experience where it's completely free to download and play. I think you get like 60 levels with it, but you can pay a few quid to unlock another 60 or something like that. And so tons and tons of these deathmatch levels where you're going to do a one-on-one fight. You're going to get dropped into a map, not know where that map is, not have any weapons in your hand when you start, but you can run around and pick them up. It has this really fun, very fast movement system with like wall runs and bum slides and that sort of stuff. And weapons which are a mixture of like rocket launcher, sniper rifles, Halo-ish, kind of Counter-Strike-ish weapons. And it's just absolutely glorious deathmatch mayhem to be dropped into a level and have to very quickly bum slide and parkour around this world that you don't understand, grabbing weapons. And then after like 12 seconds, boom, one of you's dead and it loads on the next level. And, you know, takes 5 seconds to load into the next level and you go again, you go again, you go again. I just adore it. It's just, if you grew up playing kind of 90s, early 2000s first-person shooters on dedicated servers, like just connecting to a random server and having a weird experience with strangers with text chat in Half-Life or Quake or any of these games, I think Strafdat will really appeal. And it helps that it has like an interface that looks like a sick Winamp skin. Extremely Y2K in a way that I enjoy.
Yeah. Explain the allure of Despelot or Despelote? Despeloti? Don't know how you pronounce it. It's got some of those letters in it.
I also don't know how to pronounce it, embarrassingly. So betraying my expertise here. Despelot is it's a video game memoir of which we had a couple last year about Ecuador's World Cup run in, I think, 2002, told from the perspective of, I think, like a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old boy growing up in the country and who is clearly in love with football, but is a child. And so it's a first-person narrative game with a series of vignettes where, you know, sometimes you're in the park playing with your friends, sometimes you're being led by the hand by your mother, you know, led across town and told to wait on a bench where she goes and does some work stuff. And you have to, you know, you've got 15 minutes to either wait on that bench and you can just sit there and wait for her to come back and do nothing. But you can also hear, oh, the World Cup match is being played from like some TV screens in a shop window over there. And there's some people, so maybe you go over there and you wander over and you join the crowd and you watch that for a little bit. And then you meet some of your friends and they're playing football in the park. And so you sneak off and you play some football in the park and you just have like a wristwatch on. You can look at your wristwatch and check the time and make sure you're not late getting back to the bench before your mum comes back. And that's like a 15-minute segment. And it kind of goes through the Ecuador qualifying campaign with that cultural event always glimpsed at the periphery, because obviously as a child you don't have agency really over where you are or what you're doing at any given moment. You are just dragged from place to place. Oh, we're at this cousin's wedding now. Oh, we're at my dad's VHS rental store now. and you just have to find ways of entertaining yourself in that environment, which is very often that your only real interaction is kicking stuff. So, you know, sometimes it's a ball to kick, sometimes it's a VHS case and you're just kicking that, or it's a balloon at a party and you're just kicking that. But it really plays with perspective in a way that I like, and breaks the frame of the narrative in ways that I like, because one of the things you do is you play a football video game at home, which, you know, I don't know if you remember Dino Dini. Dino Dini was a maker of football games in the 80s and 90s. Most famously, Kickoff, I think, was the series he made. There were a bunch of other ones, but they were always like, it was Dino Dini's Kickoff. Like, that was the name of the game. And in the same way as you had Sid Meier's Civilization, essentially.
Right.
So, but in this game, you know, it's Tino Tini. You're playing Tino Tini Soccer 98 or something like that on your home console, which is a kind of a top-down 16-bit era sort of football game. And, you know, you play that in the game when you're just hearing your parents talking in the other room, or your sister's bugging you because she wants to go in the game, or she wants to watch the TV program she wants to watch, and you're using the screen to play the game. And then it does really interesting things with, like, breaking the frame of that in ways that I don't want to spoil. So it's quite difficult game to talk about, which is why I'm rambling somewhat. And then the timeline of the game sort of moves on. There's a point at which it starts to incorporate the explicit perspective of the developer of the game, reflecting on their childhood, you know, talking about the process of trying to turn their memories of their childhood into a game, and, you know, showing like glimpses of Google Maps and, oh, like, I'll give you an example. There's a point at which they want to show a specific moment from an Ecuador qualifying match or World Cup match, I can't remember which, but they couldn't find clean footage of the moment because it just doesn't exist. It's like a bit something that happened on television in Ecuador several years ago. And so the only example of it they could find has like this advert for dish soap being read out over the footage of the match, because like that was just how it was broadcast at the time. Couldn't find a clean version of it. And so they have to use that in the game, and then they talk about how this is actually, like, in some ways a more perfect experience, like, example of the experience of experiencing these cultural events growing up in the country at the time. Yeah, it's a really fascinating, really personal game. And I played a bunch of games last year about kids or teenagers, all of the games felt really superficial and shallow. Like, they were being made by people who'd learned the tropes of those kinds of stories by watching lots of episodes of Dawson's Creek. That's fine. You know, if that's what you want, that's fine. But it was really refreshing to play a game which felt truthful to the actual experience of being a child. And although it's about this very particular moment in time in a country I've never been to, it felt universally relatable to me. And I think even if you don't care about football, this will help you.
What if you hate football so much that your hatred of it has become like a rasping black hole?
Well, this is why I mentioned this. Because I think this might, I don't think it will make you like football, but I think it might help you to understand your friends who do like football.
Right.
Because it is reframing, obviously, football in the UK, where I live, is so inextricable from the culture and from commercialism and a certain laddish, loutish Britishness. And this kind of reframes all of that, or like takes it away from those things, and it's a joyful thing that you're doing with your friends in the park, and a thing that which, yes, can galvanize support and enthusiasm from a nation at the same time, but it's completely divorced from any of that commercial aspects, or the, you know, oh, this team's owned by a petrochemical state, nation state, and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So it's just nice. It's lovely.
I will play it if you promise to play 1,000 times Resist.
I've played the first hour of 1,000 Times Resist and really enjoyed it, actually. Like, I really hated the first 3 minutes of it.
Yeah, same.
And then the whole segment after that was great. I got to the end of, like, the next segment. And then, I really do want to go back to it because I think I'm going to enjoy it a lot.
So, well, that deal. Makes it less of an effective bargain on my part, doesn't it?
No, it's already agreed.
Was there anything else on the list that you wanted to highlight?
I guess Dune Imperium, which has it been discussed on the podcast before?
I don't think so.
I played Dune Imperium. Well, actually, I haven't touched it in the last couple of months, but up until then, I've been playing it weekly with former Crate and Crowbar founder Tom Francis. You know, we would get on a call together on a Sunday and play a match, and it's I don't really know anything about Dune. I've never read a Dune book. I've never seen a Dune film. I'm sure I should. Everybody says it's great. Maybe one day. But Tom was so into the game that I got into it. And it's a digital recreation of a board game, which is sort of like a worker placement game. Every turn you can send an agent to a board space, and every round you've got two agents to send, and the board spaces let you collect certain resources. You're going to get water for going to this place, you're going to get spice for going to this place, you're going to get salari for going to this space. But at the same time, it's a deck building game. The agents that you're sending these agents, but they're represented by cards that you're playing, and you've got to get 10 victory points to win. If you don't get 10 victory points after 10 rounds, it triggers the end game anyway, and just whoever's ahead wins at that point. But it's so meaty and juicy with decision, meaty and juicy. God, fuck's sake. I haven't spoken about games in a long time. Oh, stop describing things as meaty. I think I'm just hungry. The decision-making space is so rich. Like, the number of ways in which you can get those victory points is huge, and so there are loads of different strategies that you can bring to it and ways you can explore. And it's only become more like that as they've expanded it, because they've done two expansions in the digital version, Rise of X and Uprising, I think is the other one, that have added so many more cards and more systems on the board and ways of leveling up your army, because there are these conflicts that you can win in order to get extra victory points. And I've played it for 160 hours on Steam and probably about 100 more on iPad.
And, oh, wow. Jeez.
And I don't think I'm done yet. And I'm not like really a big card game guy. Like, I never got into Slay the Spire in a way that a bunch of other people did. But that feeling of building an engine over the course of an hour to try to win a competitive fight is just great.
Sounds intimidating.
It definitely helped having another human being to play with. Like, right. That was a big motivation. But I will say it does have really good tutorials.
Oh, right.
Which will guide you through the process from the base game onwards and teach you the systems. It's got good AI if you just want to play against the computer. And then it has really good like challenge mode stuff, which will say, oh, well, we'll try and win this without using water at all. And like put these certain limitations on you. So it's a pretty rich offering.
Oh, being able to play it offline with bots is probably how I'd choose to do it.
Yeah. You should give it a go. Or you should play Mini Shoot Adventures. Sorry, one more.
Yeah.
Which is a top-down shmup Metroidvania. So it's set in like it's kind of like a Zelda world. You know, there's an overworld you can go around with all these little dungeon caves that you can delve into. But you're this little spaceship, and everyone else in this world is a little spaceship. And they sort of chirp and cheep at each other and sort of talk, and it's not really clear why everybody is a spaceship in this world, but it's essentially an excuse for it's a top-down shmup. So you're shooting things, gliding around, sliding. The sense of momentum and movement on the ship is really nice. The sound effects are lovely as you're fighting the enemies. It's a little bit of bullet hell, but I'm not a big bullet hell player. I don't normally gel with those kinds of games, and I find them too difficult, and I didn't with this. It's much more of that Metroidvania experience where there's a gradual power curve that you're climbing up, and it's as much about the explicit collection of abilities that are advancing you through it rather than necessarily having to be great with your thumbs in a way that I'm typically not. And it's just a really sweet, nice game. It's probably one of the best Metroidvanias I've played.
Yeah, another one I hadn't actually heard of before looking at the list. There's probably about 10 to 15 on the list that I don't think I'd it would have come across my radar if it wasn't for that.
Then we did our job well.
I would say so. Yeah, you obviously slept on 1,000 times resist, but you know, other than that, that's, I think I'd have thrown Type Help in there as well. A genre best, I would say, probably, of the information game genre, as Tom Francis calls it, which hasn't caught on as a phrase, I don't think. But Metroidbrania is what some people on... Exactly. I know, that really annoys me. Because it's nothing to do with that. It just has a word that rhymes.
Yeah. I mean, Metroidvania is a pretty terrible genre name to begin with. And I know some people use Search Action, which is, I think, is the English translation of what it's called in Japan.
I didn't know there was a word for it in Japanese particularly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Metroid and Castlevania are called Metroid and Castlevania in Japanese. or maybe they are, but the portmanteau just doesn't work when it's in a different language. But oh yeah, Search Action I've seen some people use, which I like a little bit better. I think deduction game seems to be the most popular term for Type Help and its ilk. But I feel like I am behind on that genre. I feel like it's really exploded in the last 2 years, and I haven't played really any of them from the last 2 years.
Well, I mean, but between Type Help and Case of the Golden Idol, I think those two will prove to be like the most influential / kind of exemplar versions of that genre. I actually wanted to talk about a game in that genre, if I may.
I would love it.
I played TR49, which is the new game from Inkle, a studio behind 80 Days and Overboard and...
Heaven's Vault.
Yes, that's what I was reaching for. Yeah, Heaven's Vault. TR49 is perhaps my favorite of these, with some caveats, with some very large caveats. It is like... it's more like Type Help and the Root Trees Are Dead than, say, The Return of the Obra Dinn. In that... you used just a single interface, basically, throughout to pull up records about some mysterious circumstance, which is hard to talk about without spoiling. And you make deductions based on that information, and that allows you to surface other more obscure records using this interface. And eventually you build up an idea of what has happened. And in TR49, that interface is this creaking and spluttering old computer archive, supposedly built for code breaking purposes in World War II, but it's too sophisticated for World War II technology in some ways. Even though it has this kind of the clunky aesthetic of it, it's immediately suggesting that there's some sort of alternate reality or alternate history level of technology, and it's located in this sort of dank crypt, and you're there to find a very specific, very critical thing within it. Urged on by this voice that you hear through the radio of a guy called Liam, who is somewhere close by, perhaps like above you, but can't reach you for some reason, or won't reach you. And he appears to be very nervous and anxious about what is going on in his part of the world. There seems to be some threat which is closing in. Clearly something has gone really wrong with the world, and you don't know what it is. You do know that something that you're doing could rectify it, but you don't really know how, and you don't really know who you are. Like, not you, you the player don't know who you are, but you, the character you're playing, also does not know who they are. But you quickly establish that the archive that you're looking through is full of books. Like, they are some of them are like academic papers, and some of them are novels. And they're represented in this archive by like a short quote from the book, and then there's an author name, and there's a date of publication. But the kind of the meat of each record is like a short commentary on the book by the person who archived it. And you call these texts up using this huge, really analog feeling dial, like a bit like a rotary phone, and you use it to type in two numbers followed by two letters, as in the title of the game, TR49 being an example. But what they represent is something you need to discover. It's not that difficult a revelation to reach. You quite quickly get to it. But the trick is inferring the code for a book from other information that you come across. So like the archivist commentary on one work might say that the author only wrote one more novel before their death. And then another note might say that it was published 2 years after their death, or that it was under a pseudonym, or someone else passed it off as their own, or they got married and changed their name, or it's using a different naming convention than usual, or like so on and so forth. So you get these kind of little tidbits of information that are dispersed among all the records. And it requires this sort of mix of lateral thinking and like persistence, and at least in my case, perhaps not ideally, a lot of brute force to put it together. But it generally, I didn't really mind it, because it never feels quite obtuse. It never feels that like artificially evasive. It just feels like there's a sufficient complexity of information that it requires like teasing it out in this sort of following these breadcrumb trails in quite a well-paced way. And it's very rewarding when you make a deduction and it's proven to be correct. And there's like an additional layer to this, which is that you confirm those deductions. And until you do so, like parts of an entry will remain like corrupted and unreadable. So as you go, you click on these like little quoted titles in the text to add them to this notebook. And then you pick up codes, and they are kind of jumbled around in your notebook, and you can then drag them and match them with a title. And then when you do that, it's worked and it's correct, you can go back to that that record, and the kind of record starts to clear, and you begin to hear like some narration of the quote from that that record to kind of prove that you've deduced it correctly. I don't know that part worked for me entirely, because I think part of my issue with it is that deducing or finding the code and reading the entry is sort of like, that's the critical information that you need to move the game forward, like narratively. But then like putting a title to it tends to be like either straightforward or just not that like pertinent to the plot in an odd way. It feels like that's a choice that's been made to kind of like not particularly gate anything behind proving your deductions. But then it sort of also makes that feel like it's sort of unnecessary in a sort of busy work kind of way. And it's not like the corrupted text that gets revealed. That's never, ever part of the ongoing deductive process. You never reveal anything as a result of that that then helps you.
Sorry, I'm struggling somewhat to work out the interaction here. How much of it is, you say that like the two-letter, two-number code, is that always what your ultimate interaction is? It's like, you know, you're pouring through some documents, and then you work out what the next code needs to be to move on to the next trove of information. Is that it? So you're ultimately always trying to work out a two-letter, two-number thing in order to advance.
Exactly, yeah. There are some other UI conventions which feel like leftovers, probably should have been culled in some way, but they're also helpful. So like when you come across like a quotation in the text, like a quoted title, you can then use the mouse to directly click those words and it will go into your notebook. But otherwise, pretty much everything is done through this rotary dial, putting in two letters and two numbers. And it's odd when it breaks that convention, because it feels just so singular, that idea. And then sometimes it goes, yeah, but in this case, actually, something different happens. And you're like, that part of it doesn't really sing. There's like, I think part of the problem is that the game requires you to hold a lot of information in your head as well. And having that be disrupted is really frustrating, particularly to me personally. And it loves to disrupt you. It's like, not least because this game is not just like a text-based deduction game, as I've described, but it's also an audio drama in which characters talk at you and you in character responds, and you have to prompt it to respond. And sometimes it's just like color, like the fella on the other end of this radio, Liam, sort of giving you little bits of information about the horrific state of the world, and you asking, well, yeah, but what who am I? What's going on? And not getting very satisfactory answers. But sometimes it's like specific, context-sensitive, extremely useful information. So you can't ignore it. And I don't know if that information can be gleaned by any other means. So you have to listen to it. You have to like stop what you're doing and listen to it. And I don't know. Like, I don't know about you, but if I'm reading something and then somebody says something to me, those two inputs completely cancel each other out. Like, I will not have read what is written, and I will not have heard what was said. And like, for that to happen, like, insistently and repeatedly and unpredictably while trying to like orient myself within this extremely dense and complicated fiction and grappling with an interface that you do not fully understand when you start playing it, whilst trying to hold a lot of information in my head, I found that almost hellishly frustrating.
There's no option to like finish reading to the end of the line, and then once you get there, I go, sorry, what was that?
Well, no, so it's unclear. Like, again, it's this thing where it's not quite consistent in the way it works. Sometimes you could, like, the little microphone symbol will light up saying, hey, you can click this button for some chat if you like now. And that usually indicates, but that then, if you leave it too long, that stops. And you're like, oh, did I just miss the opportunity permanently to hear what was permanent about this record? And then sometimes the character just talks to you and you can't stop it. And on top of that, there are like points in the game where it starts playing with your understanding of how the interface operates and what your input signifies. It's hard to describe what that feels like without spoiling it, but like, it happened like way too early, because like, I think that's fine to do once you understand the system, but like, I had totally not understood the system at that point, and like, to just be completely disrupted, my like half understood investigative line of inquiry, and then be pulled somewhere else completely with this completely different, so like, reset of how you understand the interface to work. Like, it set me back like a good hour, like, because I could not remember what I was doing before or how I'd get back there or what the thing I was going to do next was. And sometimes these disruptions don't even happen like preordained moments, because they can happen organically. Because when you put in a new code, you're doing it letter by letter, overwriting the previous code. But then if you accidentally enter a valid code halfway through typing the code you really wanted to type, like you change the first two letters, but the last two letters that are already there do reference like a record, but it's not the one that you're going to type, then suddenly you're whisked away. And like, every time that happens, like, I let out like a wail of genuine despair. But there's, on top of that, also one further complaint, like the text wobbles and glitches as you read it, which is like an aesthetic choice that I respect, but it's really not a good one. Like, it was instantly like migraine inducing. But the happy ending for this is that Inkle almost instantaneously listened to feedback, personally responded to my feedback that I left in the in-game feedback submission form, and released an update today, which completely removes the text wobble. Wow. And I got a personal email from Mr. Inkle, Dr. Inkle, the Lord Protector of Inkle, John Ingold himself. And like, so clearly, like, he really cares about that sort of quality of life thing and people being able to access the game on fair terms. And I suspect it'll only get better and sort of tighter with updates to come. You can actually reduce the number of, well, as the update characterizes it, you can reduce the number of audio hints that you get, which I assume makes the game a lot less chatty. But I'm not really certain what that means. I haven't, because I finished it before the update came through, so I haven't played it again. But I didn't realize they were hints.
I was going to say, do you think they were all hints and it was just because you were taking such a long time reading? Was the game like, come on, Fecko?
Yeah, I suspect it was. But like, I didn't. But what's confounding about it is that I thought it was just the narrative of the game. And it feels like it's just the narrative of the game to listen to this stuff, because they definitely aren't always helpful to what you're doing, to what you're currently doing most of the time. And they build like this important wider picture of the world, which I feel is like vital to the fiction. So I don't know whether I would toggle it off, because it feels like you're losing something of quality and importance. But I'm like, yeah, it's just one of those things. There's like this really uneasy sort of distinction between what the game intends for you to know, what it takes record of. The game takes some notes itself of your discoveries, but some of the notes it takes feel insufficient for what you've learned. And sometimes you look at your notebook and there's like a revelation that you have not had in there. And it's like, oh, that's really important. And so you kind of, I don't know what it's doing. It feels like a lot of the game is really neat and well considered. And then there's just this last 20%, which feels like it hasn't been defined or decided upon in a way.
See, that's like, interesting because I played Expelled, which was, I mean, Inkle plaudits for productivity alone because they release some video games. Expelled came out last year, I think less than 12 months ago. Mm. And it's a successor to Overboard, if you played that, which I think was a greater success, saying that it's more visual than TR49 is. You know, there's drawings of characters and settings and places, and it's entirely set within a school in the, I think, the early 20th century, a girls' boarding school, where, as the title suggests, you are about to be expelled. You're going to be accused of pushing a fellow pupil through a window, and you have to clear your name and maybe pin that blame on someone else, and so on and so forth. And it's obviously, therefore, a very different interface to what you're describing. But I had some of the same problems with it, where there would be certain scenes, once I got to a certain distance through the game, where characters seemed to sometimes reference things that it assumed that I knew, but I didn't know that, coupled with, oh, I do know a thing, I have an item I think I ought to be able to use, but for some reason there's no opportunity to present it in this situation where it would feel natural to present it. And it's a time loop game, so you're going through the same day over and over and over again for, you know, narrative structural reasons I won't go into. So, you know, each day you've learned a little bit more, you're trying to apply the previous day's learnings to get a little bit further. You get to the point where you're playing through the same loop with a very specific idea in mind. I've got this item, I'm going to go get it again, I'm going to confront someone with it at this point, and then you just can't do it. And you're like, oh, I just wasted the last 25 minutes pursuing this thing that it turns out the game doesn't account for or doesn't allow for, or maybe there's a slight variation on it that would allow for it. So do I go through the whole 25-minute loop again with that slight variation checked to see if now I can do it? Mm. And it just starts to feel like I really liked it in a lot of ways, but it started to feel like all the different possible permutations of that world was like rattling the story apart. it couldn't maintain its own internal consistency. And it sounds like, you know, when you're talking about TR49 having these vestiges of other ideas that maybe were excised that are still in there, feels like a similar thing.
Yeah, there's a few things like that. Again, like things that press against the what you expect from your interaction with that dial interface and what those codes mean. And there's a part of that which is cool. Like I like that it subverts some of what you've understood already to add this additional kind of level of deduction that later can be used to unlock further insights into records that you've already found. But even with that, it's not quite consistent in the way it works. Sometimes you need to enter a code and sometimes you don't need to enter a code. And sometimes there are revelations in there, but sometimes there aren't. There's a sort of slight looseness to it at the end, which I found vaguely frustrating. But it's hard to complain about because I think the mystery is compelling enough to drive you to completion. Like it's I don't know that the whole thing lands perfectly for me, but in a way, like it doesn't matter what the conclusion of it is, because by the time I reached the end, all of that mattered much less to me to the kind of like individual stories that I'd collected along the way. Because you uncover all these kind of these rivalries between authors, and you hear, you know, you figure out that they've been in, you know, they've had affairs or betrayed each other in these different ways, and you kind of piece together the stories of these lives just like through like reading between the lines of their bibliographies. And there's something so gratifying about that. And it's, you know, and also you hear the voices of the archivists a lot, and they have their own generational struggles, and it's like quite artfully and emotively written. And I found all of that like a joy to spend time in, despite all my other frustrations with it. So, yeah, I thought it was a terrific and thoughtful and intimate game, ultimately.
Would you describe it as meaty and juicy?
No, but I did describe it as compelling then. So we both need to be fired, unfortunately, from this podcast. What games have you found meaty and compelling and juicy recently?
So I wanted to talk about Sictori.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know about Sictori?
Only since you told me about it. I thought you said you weren't into bullet hell games. Isn't it a bullet hell game?
Well, it's a twin stick shooter rather than a bullet hell game. I'm not playing Touhou games or Touhou games, or however you pronounce that. A few weeks before this game came out, I played Geometry Wars Retro Evolved, which I played, you know, back when it first came out on Xbox Live Arcade. But I'd heard someone talk about it on a podcast, and I just had a hankering to go play it because I remember really loving it. Mm. And I discovered that, hey, this game's on Steam. This game's been on Steam for a long time, and it turns out you can still play it, and it's still great. But I found it a relatively shallow experience because the original Retro Evolved doesn't have lots of the modes that the sequels added. And as I was playing it, I was thinking, there's some really fun interactions in this that really feels great to play. I was kind of surprised that like no one's done the kind of roguelike treatment on this. You know, it feels like you could wrap this in a bunch of meta progression. I think Ball Pit was out at the time, which is obviously breakout with all that meta progression wrapped around it. So it just felt like, oh, Geometry Wars, someone should do that. And then 2 weeks later, Sictori came out and it was like, oh, it's Geometry Wars, but with some roguelike stuff and some meta progression. It's like, oh, someone was working in this, and it's by mostly by a single developer who previously worked at Housemarque, who of course are one of the heroes of the twin stick shooter. I think specifically they worked on Resogun and left before they took the pivot into third person Sony branded cinematic experiences. And Sictori is very much in that vein. You look at a screenshot of it and you think, oh, that's Geometry Wars. It's you on a grid, you're a little ship, everything is neon and glowing, and you've got blasters and you're going to blast away some geometric shapes as they spin towards you or move in certain patterns. And it feels every bit as good as Geometry Wars does to play if you just get it in your hands. It's got really fantastic particle effects and like visual style to it, and it's got wonderful propulsive dirty throbbing music that just do 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 from the moment you turn it on and through every single game mode, that you can't help but, you know, your heart rate just picks up a little bit and you're just pumping away as you're blasting the enemies. But then what it does is it layers on top all of these different systems for how you make progress both within and without a single fight. So for example, you're collecting these tokens which progress you along a power-up track, but you don't immediately get the power-up as you reach it. It's like you're collecting a resource that you're then choosing when to spend. So it's a little bit of, you know, the weakest link with Anne Robinson risk reward thing of like, how far along this track do I think I can get with my default power set before I press the button to cash it in? I can cash it in early and get like a shield upgrade, but if I want to gamble on my ability to get further down that track, then I can get a missile upgrade and that would feel really great. There are like these letters that appear on the board, and it's just a single letter, but it rotates through all the letters of the name Sictori, I think. And if you manage to collect all the letters over the course of a run, then you get like this huge short-lived burst of power that you could blast everything away with. The arena that you're fighting within is changing shape. So like it's kind of made up of triangles, and some of those triangles will be highlighted in red, and that's warning you, get out of that zone because it's about to be out of bounds. And so you fly away, and then the arena morphs, like consumes those areas. And so it'll turn into a ring, it'll turn into a star shape, it'll turn back into a rectangle and all this sort of stuff. So at the same time as you're dealing with the enemies always the ground and dodging them, so it's like pushes you into corners.
Do they get destroyed by the changing arena shape as well?
Some of them, yeah. And all of these, and then it's, so there's a campaign mode that you're fighting through with bosses at different stages. There's difficulty levels, so you can start off as I'm playing on like the easy mode. If you're anything like me, you're going to stay on the easy mode forever, because this is a hard fucking game. This is obviously a game made for people that are really good at 2D shmups. And I think if you're good at 2D shmups, then this is like a real feast of a video game for you. You know, this is something that feels as good as the arcade classics, but has these systems and these own ideas to give it this, I think, greater longevity. I'm not good enough to like grapple with any of those things. So I can get like past the first boss in the campaign mode and then not past any other bosses. Thankfully, what it does is like over the course of about the first half hour that you're playing it, maybe 60 minutes, you will unlock six other modes. That includes my favorite, which is Surge mode. Because one of the abilities that your ship has is you can do this little dash move, which you shoop forward, and at the end of that shoop, you let out a little blast wave that destroys any enemies in your path. If you just do that, then you have to wait for the cooldown to run out before you can do it again. But if you shoop into a token, then you can chain them together because you get an instant recharge by picking up a power up with that dash move. Surge starts you off with a much more powerful gun than you would have in the campaign or any of the other modes. So you immediately feel more powerful, and and doing that dash move to pick up a token then ups you to an even higher fire rate, where you're blasting out missiles for a very short period of time, maybe like 5 or 6 seconds. So it becomes this thing of chaining together those power-up collections in order to keep yourself in the higher fire rate mode for as long as possible, and strips away some of the other stuff in terms of like bosses and the progression that you get through the campaign mode. It gives me that feeling of power that I feel like I would maybe get from the campaign if I was any good at it. It's also, there's a mode in there, I think in Geometry Wars it was called Pacifism, where you can't shoot, but there are these gates, and you fly through the gates in order to
my favorite
enemies. So Sictori has that. I think it might just be called gates here rather than pacifism mode. Pacifism mode never really made sense to me. Sure, I can't shoot, but I am blowing all these things up. So I think it's just called gates, and so like I've played a lot of that as well. But it's really just the best example of this genre I'm terrible at that I've played in years and years and years. And I really am bad at this game. I keep repeating this, but when I play it and I get my like B rating at the end of a run or whatever, it then tells me I'm like 230th on the leaderboards, which is just a signal that not nearly enough people are playing this video game. I think it started to pick up a little bit in recent weeks because a few people picked it as their game of the year last year. Simon Parkin on his podcast, My Perfect Console, for example, named it as his favorite game of 2025. He is a person who's good at these kinds of games, and so I understand that. And I've heard it get shouted out on a few other things, but it's the kind of game where I'm not good enough at it to persist with it. I've probably reached a point where every time I play this game, I feel good and then die, and I'm starting to run out of that desire to keep going back because I know I'm just going to die again and have the same experience. I'm not going to advance. But it's a game that it deserves a much larger audience than it has, because it's obviously like a real master craftsman of the shmup genre who has made this thing for people to appreciate.
Oh, I hope it picks up. I hope it does well.
Yeah, I really hope so. The other game I wanted to speak about was Big Hops. Very different kind of game. Have you heard of Big Hops, Marsh?
Again, no. I had to look up a screenshot of it, and it does look delightful, I have to say.
Yeah, I think I just saw this on Steam and was like, that trailer looks cute. It's about a frog. And it's a 3D platformer, very much in the Mario mode, very much in the Mario Odyssey mode, I would say. Where you're a little frog living in a forest with your mum and your sister, and you get magicked away by a sort of trickster character called Dis, who sounds a lot like Elijah Wood, weirdly. I checked. It's not voiced. He's not voiced by Elijah Wood. But he whisked you off to another dimension, and then other worlds beyond it. They're all connected by this place called The Void. And you're on a mission to essentially get back home to your mum and sister by finding these airship parts. But this, at each point, takes you to, oddly, like a world where some sort of conflict is happening. And that conflict mostly relates to, like, municipal services are breaking down. Like, the first world, there's a sinkhole is opened up in the middle of this town and they're having problems with their water supply that you need to solve. And then in the second world, it's like the oil rig is breaking down and there's this conflict between the hydropower plant and the oil rigs. And I'm really not sure where the narrative of it is going. Point is, it's extremely colorful and cute. And it's really about your 3D platforming moveset. That's the reason to recommend it. Hop, the main character, he can jump, he can climb, he can roll. If you jump coming out of a roll, then you get a boost in speed, which allows you to jump further. If you jump and then dive, you can gain up a little bit of speed by sliding on your tummy. If you're going downhill, you pick up speed there. If you chain those moves together, the rolls, the jumps, and the dives, you can pick up ridiculous amounts of speed bounding across these landscapes. You can do crouch jumps. You can climb. You know, there's a little bit of a stamina meter on there. It's kind of Breath of the Wild style climbing. A little meter is going to come up on the screen, and if you run out of juice, you're gonna fall off. But then you're going to chain all these moves together in order to climb these big oil rig structures, or to the climb of cities and ravines and gorges and all this sort of stuff. And it always feels really expressive and great in the hands. You're also a frog. So the other big activity is licking everything with your tongue. Essentially, you grab handles with your tongue in order to flip switches and that sort of stuff.
Oh, nice.
But it's also a grapple hook that you can use to swing from certain things. And yes, there's a lovely feeling of momentum and physics-y feel as you're swinging from these things. And then there are all over the world, in different levels, you'll come across different kinds of vegetable. Doesn't really make any sense here, but they're like fruits or vegetables growing on plants that you can pluck with your tongue and then throw in order to place down a kind of movement item. So like I'll just give you an example because it's easier to talk about in the specifics, but you find some mushrooms, you can pick up the mushrooms, put some in your backpack. If you throw a mushroom at the ground, it makes a jump pad, and now you can use that to reach an area that maybe was previously unreachable. Right. Or you'll get like a green plant that will stick to a wall and it will fire out two green balls that look like peas, and those are basically grapple points that like suck you towards them and then launch you out the other side of them. So like you will have to stick the pea blaster to a wall at one point, knowing that that's going to shoot these two balls in this direction over here to where you need to make the jump to get across a gap, and then time it so that you jump off the ledge at the right moment. Just as the ball comes back, you grapple to it with your tongue and it flings you, and then you land on the second one and chain that together. And I'm at the point now where I think it's a relatively short game. I'm like 6 or 7 hours. I think I'm about 4 or 5 hours in. I think it's introduced about 7 or 8 of these different abilities, from plants that launch tight ropes for you to walk across to like things that look like grapes, but they inflate like balloons, so you can tie them to things and cause objects to float up into the sky. Hop's great deficiency in life is that he can't swim, but I've just unlocked the ability to swim, and you're chaining together your moves underwater to go between these air bubbles, which are how you restore your ability to stay underwater. And so it's really dense with ideas. It feels really great in the hands. I would say almost as good as Mario Odyssey, which I think is probably the best in class for this genre. Where it's kind of falling apart is maybe in some of the puzzle design, where there are these difficulty spikes with the use of the vegetables in order to navigate particularly tricky areas, where you've got two different kinds of vegetable that you've got to place in particular areas and then just nail the timing perfectly to get them to work. It's particularly difficult with those green peas I was describing, because they only fires a single plant only fires two of those, and then if you screw it up, you have to go back to the plant, p- pick up another thing. Sort of the language of this. Go back to the bush, let's say. Go back to the bush, pick another bud from it, fire the bud back at the wall, maybe choose a different location, wait for the thing that the bud then fires out of it to reach the right point, grapple to it just at the right angle and at the right time so that your momentum on the other side of it takes you to where you need to go. And then maybe you then have to do it again from like a moving platform that you're now standing on because you've like, you grabbed one of them and put it in your backpack. You don't have access to the bush now where you are, but you grabbed one of the buds and put it in your backpack. So now you've got to do it again. And if you fuck that up and fall, you're going to die and it's going to reset you back to the first ledge. So you have to do the first jump again. and there are just points where your mistakes can sort of compound as well, because like those tight ropes, for example, sometimes you'll be standing on a ledge looking down over the side, trying to shoot a tightrope down below you, and it will just hit the ledge at your feet, even though the targeting reticle on the screen is like far, far away from the ground at your feet. There's some disconnect where, because you're so close to the ground that you're standing on, I'm always close to the ground that I'm standing on, then the tightrope just bashes off that and then just travels like a very small distance, which is just useless. Fine, okay, there's always just another bush. The plants on them regrow immediately. You go grab it again. But you now have this tightrope on the ground that does nothing and doesn't disappear, and you can't remove it. And there's a little bit of like magnetism to those things where it will suck you on them, which is really useful if you're flying through the air at speed, really hoping to land on it. But when it's just now a thing on the ground that you didn't want there, and you keep getting magnetically sucked into it I was trying to jump off this ledge to get the green thing, and now I've missed the green thing, and so I have to go do that again. And then the same thing. It's just, there have been points where I, you know, was trying to snap my Xbox controller in half with pure frustration. But it's there are so few 3D platformers of this type on PC even now. It's a real pleasure to play one that just nails the fundamentals of movement. And it's almost in some ways like being too ambitious with all the vegetable stuff. Like that feels like the equivalent of Mario Odyssey's ability to like throw the hat. And it's maybe not steering me as much as I want. I maybe just want there to be like a mark on the wall where it's like, fire your fucking thing here, idiot. And
right.
And then the challenge is the platforming thing. The ambiguity of, I'm not quite sure where you want me to put this. I have to choose it for myself and like creatively find my own way across. No, I don't want to be creative. I just want to do the platforming challenges. Tell me where to put this fucking thing, where the designer intended for me to put it. And I'd probably be having more fun, but yeah.
Have you been playing it on like a Steam Deck, or you've been playing it on your full-fat PC?
On my full-fat PC, but I bet it would run well on Steam Deck.
Right.
It does have a little bit of that feeling of Little Gator Game. Did you play that?
I didn't play it, but I did. I think I've seen it.
Did you play A Short Hike?
I did play A Short Hike.
Little Gator Game feels like tonally, and in terms of the activities and the world that you're exploring, feels a lot like A Short Hike. But, as if from the next console generation, the camera's following you in third person, and it's that kind of Big Hops feels like that. Like it's certainly much more about the momentum. And Little Gator Game is great. And the reason I mention it is because that's a game that I played on Steam Deck. I bet Big Hops would feel good on that device.
A frog called Hop is like the lowest level of nominative determinism possible.
Yeah, I know. But I forgive it because it's also the name of the game. Yeah. And so there's the...
No, it's not a bad name. I just think it'd be... It's just a disappointment, isn't it? I mean, it's like me being called, I don't know, sit at desk. like, didn't my parents have higher aspirations for me than that, you know?
Well, this is obviously what we should do, you know, like, my last name is Smith, but I am not any kind of Smith, really. I'm not doing any smithing.
You're a wordsmith.
I hate that term. You can be Marsh sit at desk if that's what you feel like your job is now. If that's your role within society and what you contribute to our little village.
Yeah, if that.
You don't want to be Marsh podcast?
No, not really. I feel like that career has been firmly tainted by all the other podcasters.
Yeah, this is fair. Imagine, yeah, there's a lot of terrible people you would be sharing your second name. I always feel like we should. It would be fun to do it like they do it in Iceland. What's your dad's name?
Graham.
Ah, excellent. So you would be Grahamson. Yeah. Marsh Grahamson.
Yeah. A fine name shared by at least two people that I like.
who's the other one? Who's the other Graham? I must kill him immediately.
Do you want to talk about anything else?
No.
Then we shall end the podcast here.
Go visit my website, jank.cool.
You should indeed do that. Yes. And look out for all the exciting things that they will do there, including other podcasts. Is the podcast just going to be called a Jank podcast, or is it going to have its own?
It will have its own name, but we haven't come up with that name yet. We've got a concept for it. Which, you know, so the name will reflect the concept, but more on that later. At the moment, we've just got lovely words for people.
Well, in the meantime, go to jank.cool and sign up. Give them lots of money. You can also give us money as well at Crate and Crowbar if you want to. That's via Patreon. You can back us at patreon.com/CrateandCrowbar or join our lovely Discord community, as well as jank.cool's lovely Discord community, the link for which is on our website, crateandcrowbar.com. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
I've been Graham Smith.
Thank you for redeeming our reality, Graham. Everything is better now. Everything is better.
You're most welcome. I'm glad that I could make this world meaty and juicy.